Fred was eyeing her. Oops, Alexis thought. Nabbed. Damn it. When she felt like giggling again, she knew for sure she shouldn't have had that last glass. Number two, or three, or four. What the hell? It had been a long and difficult day. Who wouldn't drink a little too much wine? She'd let Bernadette and Hank take the lead, speaking with Jessica. Animated and more coherent than when they left her at lunchtime, she had soon grown tired. They were all still exhausted, too, so they kept the visit brief. The best news was that Jessica would be sent home soon, perhaps the next day. Today, they were all busy taking care of errands while awaiting word from the hospital. Hank was trying to keep his business ventures afloat, and Bernadette was catching up on a backlog of tasks related to the management of the Rancho Mirage estate. They agreed to drive to the hospital in the late afternoon, even if they hadn't heard anything. That way, at least they could spend a little time with Jessica. Alexis grabbed a bite to eat, and then used the headache that was overtaking her as an excuse to take a nap. Bernadette didn't pursue the matter, perhaps distracted by chores. Back in her room, Alexis mulled over that morning meeting with her doctor. She had to do something, and she would, too, when things were back to normal. Soon, but not now. Not today. Once Jessica was home and up on her feet again, and Hank moved back to Brentwood, then she could think more about taking care of herself. There was also the little matter of filing for separation from Giovanni. She'd been making excuses to account for the delay in her return to the Mediterranean. Twice she'd stopped Giovanni from coming to the desert. She wasn't sure she could resist him face to face, nor could she stall him much longer. Surely no one expects me to face all of this alone. Everyone relies on others occasionally. Who doesn't need a crutch now and then? She whispered. She wasn't talking about people, but the pills. People she could do without. Pills, maybe not. She sat on the side of the bed and reached into the drawer of the elegant nightstand. The pill bottles rattled as the drawer opened, and she grabbed one, almost at random. Relaxation, mood enhancement, pain reduction, it was all much the same thing. At night, there was the extra oomph she needed to sleep. She had a couple of things for that, since Ambien didn't always do the trick. Popping a lid off the bottle, she glanced at the label. Good enough, she said, as she put not one but two pills in her mouth. She tried to count how many pills she'd taken that day. Tracking was a difficult problem when using alcohol and pills. Rules about what, when, and how much she would consume worked well for dieting, but not so well for substances that altered memory and resolve. Oh, what the hell, she said. Once the pills worked and she'd had a nap, she'd figure it out. She had skipped the wine Hank opened for lunch, keeping her promise to herself not to drink until dinner time. Later, she would get up to check on her daughter. Until then, there wasn't much she could do anyway. Besides, Bernadette could do whatever needed to be done. She and Hank were so much better suited to those tasks, and Alexis wouldn't have to see them watching her. Hank, with that vision of her as the woman he imagined her to be, and Bernadette hovering, waiting for Alexis to do the right thing. Both believed she was an adult, a mother, and a woman of substance. What she was, and what she was content to be if the world would leave her alone, was a hollow, empty shell of a person. That's what she'd always been. Just like you, Emma Baldwin, you couldn't fool me, not even with all that straight posture, stiff upper lip, and clean living. You were as much a mannequin as I am. More so. All form and no substance. You should have worn shades, Mummy, to hide that empty look in your eyes. If you'd ever let your hair down for even a minute, you would have dissolved into thin air. Alexis spoke the words aloud to the large, empty master bedroom as she drifted toward oblivion. 9. Code Silver. Nurse Andrews bustled about the room. Was this only Jessica's second day in the hospital? No, technically it was her third. She remembered little of that first night spent in the ICU. Despite threatening to sick the nurse on Tommy and the guys yesterday, she couldn't take much more of the well-meaning but officious Nurse Andrews. It would be so wonderful to go home. Well, the closest thing she had to a home these days, given she was squatting in her parents' estate in Rancho Mirage where she'd grown up. It still wasn't clear if she'd be released today, but she was too tired to fight about it. Jessica, do you feel up to some company? Laura Stone popped her head in the door as she spoke, and then swept into the room without waiting for an answer. Laura had recently returned to work following the murder of her husband, Roger Stone. An operating room nurse here at the hospital, she wore scrubs. The shoulder-length bob she had worn since high school framed her sweet, caring face. Yes, come on in. I'm so glad to see you. Jessica glanced at Nurse Andrews, expecting a signal she and Laura were breaking a rule, fraternizing, or something like that. Laura hugged Jessica and then sat down in the chair nearest the bed. Nurse Andrews gave Laura an officious nod of acknowledgement as she zipped out of the room. "Where have you been?" she asked, relaxing as Nurse Andrews exited. "I stopped by several times and even sneaked in once while you were in the ICU, just to make sure they were taking proper care of you." As she spoke those words, she dropped the level of her voice a little, as though she might be overheard. "You've been sleeping a lot, girl. A deep sleep, too. I tried to get through to you, but no luck, even after they moved you out of intensive care yesterday. I ran into Tommy and Jerry, who said you were doing great. By the time I got in here, you were out cold. I heard you had a visit from Frank, too." She smiled and then glanced at the door to make sure Nurse Andrews had shut it when she left the room. "This is for you," she said, as she handed Jessica the large cup of coffee she'd brought into the room with her. "This'll wake you up for sure." "I love you so much. You're an angel sent from heaven." She sipped greedily at the cup, even though the coffee was hot. "Not me. I hear that's your title these days. It's all over the news. Even Diane Sawyer featured a clip of the rescue and said a few words about Jessica Huntington, the angel heiress. I wouldn't be surprised if you have the paparazzi after you." "Great. Just what I need. With any luck, Jim's beloved will do the right thing and pitch another fit in some highly visible location. That baby has got to be here any minute." "She looks like she's about to pop," Laura said. "You are so right." Cassie, the worm-hearted Harper, was about twice the size she'd been the day Jessica caught her with Jim in flagrante. Not that impending motherhood has triggered anything maternal. I suppose you caught her latest tantrum. Jessica winced as she spoke, with the recollection of yet another embarrassing and very public meltdown by the new Mrs. James Harper. Laura nodded in solemn affirmation. "Wasn't that hideous?" Jessica leaned her head back on the pillow, closing her eyes. The whole scene ran over in her head like a bad B-movie. The latest altercation had occurred outside a local luncheon hotspot in Beverly Hills. The Flavor of the Month film star had stopped on the street to sign an autograph, all bubbles and smiles as she left the restaurant. When a server ran out to return her purse, she thanked the server with air kisses to both cheeks. Then she'd turned to her assistant and flown into a rage. Tourists that had already been snapping pics and recording clips of the bloated film star caught the whole scene. "You stupid, stupid cow! What do I pay you for? How could you have let me walk out without my bag?" Spit flew as Cassie yelled. The stunned young woman, reportedly the fifth personal assistant in as many months, just stood there. Something bovine had overcome her as she endured that loud, mortifying tongue-lashing. Her placid stance further enraged the engorged star of stage and screen. The newly minted Mrs. Harper pummeled her cowed assistant about the head and shoulders with the purse returned to her by the server. Horrified onlookers gawked as the young personal assistant, covering her head to ward off the blows, sort of slid down the wall near the entrance to the restaurant. Diners sitting near the windows inside the restaurant stood, craning their necks to see what was happening outside. "What are you looking at?" the People's Choice Award nominee wailed. She flashed her middle finger to the diners indoors. Then she lunged at bystanders outside, her long red nails taking swipes at them. "Get the hell out of here! This is between me and my so-called assistant." "But that's assault. You can't hit someone like that. I'm calling 911, a bystander sputtered. I can't. Who says I can't? You will not call anyone. Cassie was shrieking at the top of her lungs and took a couple steps toward the man using his cell phone. He turned sideways just in time to avoid being hit by the Gucci bag she was wielding like a medieval flail. Another onlooker, closest to the dazed personal assistant, took advantage of the momentary distraction to swoop down and yank the assistant to her feet. The irate actress spotted them as they bolted and took off in pursuit, belly first, buttons and zippers popping. She had advanced a few paces when she realized the futility of her actions. Stopping, she kicked off her shoes, picked one up, and hurled it at the fleeing woman. When she reached down for the second shoe, her pants split. At that moment, her fans got to see way more of the real deal than they might ever have expected to see, given that a body double had been used in her films of dubious acclaim. A Hollywood diva moons Beverly Hills fans, headline went viral, along with photos sent out on Instagram. The media circus, never far from the she-beast, had caught up with her by then. Most of the debacle was recorded on video in high def. The good news for Jim, if there was any, was that he wasn't there to get caught on film too, nor did cameras catch him bailing the banshee out of jail. Taken into custody, the family lawyer, not Jim, secured her release. However, when the media replayed the incident ad nauseam, an older image of Jim was plastered on the TV screen alongside his beloved. I bet she's not at all happy that the ex-Mrs. Harper is getting more attention than the current one. You're stealing her limelight, you know. Some entertainment news show has connected the two of you, so she's been getting exposure out of this, too. Oh, no. Please, not that. All I need is to be linked to that ding-dong in a tabloid love triangle. Is that what they're doing? Jessica was almost afraid to ask. Well, I didn't actually see it. You should ask Bernadette. I'm sure she has all the details. What I heard is, since you're dubbed the Angel Heiress, they've set her up as the Devil Temptress, or something like that. A halo on you and horns on her. Laura giggled. I have to admit, that is kind of funny, she said, and laughed. Maybe she'll go into labor and have that baby at Tiffany's or another favorite spot on her stomping grounds. And I do mean stomping. You just have to hope you're not the one on the ground being stomped. Jessica had trouble getting the words out. She was laughing so hard. Oh, ouch, that hurts, she said, grabbing her side as her laughter jarred her ribs. If that happens, I bet they put little devil horns on that poor baby, too. The momentary look of pity on Laura's face was more than Jessica could bear and set off more laughter. I can see the headline now. Succubus gives birth to Satan's baby on Rodeo Drive. Jim should ask for a paternity test to make sure Satan's not daddy, don't you think? Stop! Have mercy, please! Ow, ow, ow! She got another jolt of pain from her ribs. Tears were streaming from her eyes. At least you'll be back behind the gates in Mission Hills soon. You can hide out until the media circus moves on. That's true, but it will be stranger than ever going home now. Not only is Mom back, but Dad's there too. Mom is being so weird. This breakup with Giovanni is harder on her than I ever dreamed it would be. She's usually so cavalier about things like that. At least, that's what I've always thought. We both know that it's not so easy losing a husband. That's true, but she's had more practice at it than we have, she said, pausing for another sip of coffee. What's she doing that's so weird? I don't know. She's distant, evasive, hides out in her room a lot. If she was in there buying things online, I'd get that, but she doesn't even own a computer. No binge shopping trips or spa days anymore, either. There were a few of those when she first got to the desert back in July. I have these deja vu moments about her disappearing act, like what went on when she was divorcing Dad. It was almost like I lost her, too, when Dad moved out. I've tried to get her to talk about it, but she brushes me off and runs away. It strikes me as odd, but then I've never thought of her as normal. Isn't that awful? Well, I don't know what you mean by normal. I've never thought of her as weird. Over the top, definitely. I thought it was how all rich moms behaved, you know? She seems a lot like those women on that Beverly Hills Housewives show. Yeah, well, some of them are plenty weird in my book. They have so many problems, terminal shallowness being one of them. Then who doesn't, huh? Here before you sits a woman who just told you she could understand it if her mother was running away to her bedroom to jump on a computer and shop. I'm griping about Mom after she sat up all night with me while I was in the ICU, speaking to me. Even though I couldn't make out most of what she was saying, it was comforting. I love her, even if I don't get her, you know? Sure, maybe with some people that's the best you can hope for. To love them, no questions asked. She and Laura looked at each other. They both must have been thinking about their lost husbands, unknown and unknowable, even before they disappeared from their lives. Then they cleared their throats, almost in sync. No, forget that. I'll keep asking questions, even if it turns me into a nag. I agree. Ask all the questions you can while you can. You never know when someone will slip away. Laura's voice was almost prayerful as she uttered those last few words. She sipped more coffee, wondering how much of the headache dogging her for the past couple of days was caffeine withdrawal. The orderly had brought her a dark brown watery substance that morning. She had downed the 6-ounce cup in a couple of gulps. The cup in her hand wasn't her usual high test, brewed in a French press, but it was good. The coffee, the laughter, or maybe Laura's companionship had eased the headache. Jessica stopped sucking at the coffee long enough to inspect her friend. How are you doing? You look wonderful. I'm okay. It's still hard to be back at work. I don't have my working woman mojo in high gear yet. Tell me about it. Things were taking on the semblance of a routine, and then I have to fall off a frigging mountain. It's always something, I suppose. That struck Laura as funny, and she snorted. Yeah, falling off a mountain will not help you fine-tune your mojo. I don't plan to do that soon, nor am I starting a new job like you. I haven't tangoed with as many lowlifes as you have in the past year, even if you count one or two of the realtors I ran across during my condo search. You're at least half a dozen creeps ahead of me. Laura shuddered a little, but laughed again. You've had more than your fair share, too. I will definitely have to add creep attractor to my superpowers. It's right up there with calamity magnet. If there's a fiasco out there somewhere, you can bet I'll find it, especially if there's a creep at the center of the melee. My specialty is attracting well-heeled heels, I might add, starting with James Harper, Esquire. I'm amazed, though, at how well you're doing. You're one tough woman. Laura smiled, but a more somber demeanor had settled upon her lovely countenance. I still have nightmares about finding Roger like I did, but I'm sleeping better. I almost never cry myself to sleep anymore. There are fewer moments when I think I see him out of the corner of my eye, or catch myself thinking I'd better remember to tell Roger this or ask Roger that. I understand a little of what you're going through. You have your own post-trauma calendar running, like the one I started in March after walking in on Hollywood Barbie and two-timer Ken. Let's hope there's some truth in the notion that a year makes loss easier to bear. I hope so. The women in my grief group keep reassuring me things will get better. And they are. At least the money stuff is better, thanks to that double indemnity payout. Who knows how many more creeps I would have had to deal with, though, if you hadn't helped me get that check. You've been my angel, too. Aw, stop it. You're making me blush. Speaking of calamities and creeps, what's going on with the missing and misguided girls of 90210? We haven't had a cat pack get together since you all came to my housewarming party, so I need updating. I guess Dr. Carr is the latest well-heeled creep at the center of an ongoing calamity. You thought he was up to no good? That's for sure, she said, and gave Laura a brief rundown of what had occurred on Mount San Jacinto. So what happens now? Laura asked. If I'm out of here by Friday, we'll have a cookout. Bernadette's already planning the feast. Consider this an invitation. In the meantime, Jerry, Tommy, and Kim are all tracking down a few things while I'm being held captive here. Paul is running interference for me at the office and will touch base with Libby's parents so I don't have to face them yet. Frank's holding off Uncle Don and his buddies at the Palm Springs Police Department while I sort out a few things that are still hazy in my mind. I guess I'm safe as long as I'm in the hospital. Sooner or later, though, I'll have to run the gauntlet of stern-faced police officers and spill my guts. While the police figure out what killed Carr, I want to get a better handle on what he and Libby were ranting about. Part of what he was up to was getting Libby to extort money from her parents. When I chat with Detective Hernandez, I'll see if he can ask Shannon's father a few more questions and see if he was being extorted by his daughter. The other thing I want to pursue is Libby's claim that she was being screwed by her shrink, literally as well as figuratively.
No, she was sleeping with the man? Isn't that illegal?
Laura was aghast. It's not illegal, but it is actionable, a breach of ethics. Most likely it would have meant a slap on the wrist, unless he'd been sanctioned before. Carr came up clean the first time they ran a check, but Tommy and Jerry are taking another look. He could have challenged her claim, unless she has evidence of a tryst, as she also claims.
Oh, ick, ick, ick. What on earth does that mean?
I'm not sure, since we didn't get that far along in the discussion before the man of her dreams turned up, gun in hand. I'm sorry to keep asking so many questions. That had to be terrifying. I wish I could say no, but, alas, I'm still a wimp when facing gun-toting maniacs. Anyway, Libby mentioned Monica Lewinsky, so I assume she has one or more touching mementos of cozy moments spent with Dr. Dick, as she so lovingly referred to him at one point.
That also means she must have had doubts about his being Mr. Wright, or Dr. Wright in this case.
Yes, and she also said that evidence is stashed in a little blue bag, a suitcase maybe, a tote or an overnight bag. Who knows what or where it is? My thinking wasn't too clear, or I would have asked more questions before taking that leap into the abyss.
Falling like that must have been awful.
It was. I don't remember landing, thank goodness. I wouldn't be worrying about any of this now if I'd missed that ledge and hadn't landed in a nice cushy spot. Libby wasn't as lucky.
Luckier than Dr. Dick?
I'm sorry about Libby. Even though you got pulled into this because of your relationship with her parents, I know you had hope for Libby. I'm sure that's why she continued to contact you. Like that day she spoke to you while we were eating lunch. She sure didn't hide much from me. You were so kind to her. I bet that's why she called you, thinking you'd relay her confession to her parents in a sympathetic way.
It could be, I guess.
She did seem vulnerable, but I was mainly focused on sending her back to her own lawyer and keeping the contact to a minimum. Until this latest incident, anyway. At least I have a better understanding of how those allegations toward her father and her uncle came about. Mix one part malicious Libby with a conniving shrink, throw in a bunch of drugs, and you get a toxic cocktail.
No one would have taken her seriously, given her history as you've described it.
Laura had such a serious look on her face.
That's true. She risked creating more trouble for herself, too. Depending on what she said, how and to whom, she could have opened herself up to charges of libel or slander.
She used those terms during her rant. Carr must have cautioned her against spreading the story around.
I suppose extortion doesn't work all that well if the allegations are already out there. What's the point of threatening to make them public if you've already leaked them?
True. Maybe one of the bottom feeders in my profession she hired to sue her parents warned her early on to shut up.
Sue her parents?
Dread arose on Laura's face.
Yeah, that's another threat she made, with the shrink backing her up. She's on her third low-life lawyer aiming to use the courts to extort money. They could have been the ones who told her that you can't sue for your inheritance early in exchange for signing a non-disclosure clause if you've already blabbed to everyone you know or broadcast your story of woe on Facebook.
Kim's checking into that. She's a whiz on the computer. If Libby's left a trail on the internet,
That could mean more trouble for her when she comes out of the coma. It might also provide more clues about Libby's relationship with Dr. Dick, Shannon, or another daughter of woe in Carr's harem.
More women, she murmured, as Jessica drifted away.
Jessica had to stop herself from plunging into the pit that this case had opened for her again. What was wrong with people like Libby and Jim, or those fiends responsible for murdering Roger and Kelly? She felt her anxiety rev up. Both her shrink and the priest had told her to stop it when her mind crawled too close to that well of darkness. "Let go, let God," Father Martin had said when she lamented about the unfathomable nature of depravity. "You can't right every wrong in the world. You've got your hands full getting your own life back on track."
"Duh,"
was what she'd wanted to say in reply to the well-meaning cleric. "True," was what she said instead. Then he had shifted the focus back to pondering her failed marriage and her shopping compulsion. She'd put that black Amex card away, but the numbers on that card were flashing through her mind even now. Shopping sounded enticing as she snapped back into the moment, draining the last of the coffee to bring her into the present and away from the urge to shop. Nothing Libby said would have stood up in a court of law. Not these days, anyway. In the 80s, there was a rash of court cases based on recovered memory of alleged abuse. A lot of those allegations later proved to be false because the accuser retracted them, or some bit of evidence cleared the poor schmuck targeted by them. Police and courts have backed off pursuing charges based solely on recovered memories, some of them involving paying out hefty settlements to those who wrongfully accused others. Memory is tricky. Even eyewitness testimony has been proven unreliable. Throw in mind-warping wonder drugs, and the line between lying and believing the lie gets thinner, I suppose. Anyway, if I can get out of here soon, I intend to keep a date with an old friend. Do you remember Betsy Stark?
I do. Who could forget Betsy Stark?
She used to help around your house whenever we were in high school. I remember her tagging along and towering over Bernadette. I was younger when Betsy turned up at the house one day. She must have been about 16 then. She was already closing in on 6 feet tall and big, too. I was afraid of her at first.
I could see how you might be wary of the woman. Model tall, but not model thin, she made quite an impression.
That's not all I remember, though. You also seemed more than a little jealous, as I recall. She had an amused look on her face.
You were a snotty little beast around her on more than one occasion.
Stop it, please. I'm horrified thinking about that now. Let's blame it on the divorce and all the chaos that went on before that, right about the time Betsy showed up. I was through most of the trauma drama when I met you, but I hadn't gotten over my feelings of insecurity. It bothered me to share Bernadette with Betsy. Sibling rivalry between two strays adopted by Bernadette.
I'm sorry you felt like a stray. Betsy was smart, though, right? She enrolled in community college while we were at St. Teresa's.
What has she got to do with any of this?
She's a social worker, licensed and with a master's degree. According to Bernadette, Betsy has training in behavioral health from UCLA or USC or somewhere like that.
She's also had case management experience with people who have serious mental health problems, and she knows the ins and outs of the disability system.
I'm hoping she can get me a better handle on what was going on with Libby and Carr. I'll apologize to her, too.
Gosh, I haven't thought about her in years, but who could forget Betsy Stark, the Titan?
Laura paused as the door to the hospital room burst open.
Speaking of giants, look who's here.
Yo, we brought you lunch, Brian, the pool boy cum bodyguard, announced as he entered the room carrying bags of takeout food in both hands.
Did Nurse Andrews say this was okay? Jessica asked as he set the food down on the windowsill. Behind him was the giant Laura had referred to. Peter March was carrying drinks. Both Brian and Peter were muscular, but Peter was huge. At 6'6", he resembled one of those guys striking a pose on the cover of a bodybuilding magazine, even when standing at ease. Brian, at 5'8", was Peter's mini-me, a shorter, more compact version of the man, an alter ego, too, Brian's loquaciousness counterpoint to Peter's reticence. Both men had come to Jessica's aid as members, in good standing, of the Cat Pack. Hey, who will stop them? Brian has that, don't mess with me, it's feeding time, look on his face. Brian beamed, taking Laura's statement as a compliment. I suppose you're right. I doubt anybody in this wing of the hospital would get in your way, eh, Peter? Let them try to stop me. I'm a man on a mission. Peter laughed. The head of a high-profile security firm in the desert area, he was more than capable of finishing any mission he set upon. That broad smile he wore never quite seemed right on his face, shaped by years of special ops training and life experience Jessica didn't want to know about. Jessica looked down for a few seconds, digging into a bin of French fries Brian had handed her. When she looked up again, Kim Reed was standing at the foot of the bed. The young woman appeared out of nowhere, as she so often did. She was no longer wearing an outfit befitting a member of the secretarial pool on an episode of Mad Men. Her previous employer had insisted she dress that way to please him. Kim had an edge about her, though, and it was more than the vibrant tattoo of the Hindu goddess Saraswati that ran shoulder to elbow. Kim now wore her jet-black hair in a short, asymmetrical bob. Her coal-black eyes were dramatic, with thick lashes and dark eyeliner adding to the drama. The dark hair and eyes sat in contrast to pale skin and bright red lips. She wore a simple, straight black skirt and a gray chunky cardigan with cap sleeves and small ribbed pockets. A high collar and offset panels gave it flair that had qualified it to go into the buy pile when Jessica had fitted Kim out with a wardrobe for work. There was an interior stillness about her that went with the silent movements, a cloak of invisibility cultivated to enhance her survival while working for a very bad man. I brought dessert, Kim added, expressionless. Cookies. Not just any cookies, Peter announced. Those are vegan, peanut butter, chocolate chip, oatmeal cookies. Peter the Giant was an enthusiastic vegan. Don't worry, I tested them on the way here. They're righteous, even if they are good for you, Brian said, while stuffing French fries into his mouth. That's why I'm holding the bag. Brian's testing was getting out of hand. We wanted to make sure there would be some for the rest of us when we got here. Kim's lips twitched upward for a split second, the hint of a smile. I made them stop and get double doubles for us, Jessica. Bringing you a fake burger didn't seem right with all the bogus stuff that's been going on around you. That's what they're eating. He jerked his head toward Peter and Kim, who were pulling burgers out of a different bag. A lock of surfer boy bleached blonde hair fell back into place with a jerk of his head. You can thank me for getting you real food. What about me? Laura asked. I'll share mine with you, Jessica offered. No sweat. We've got you covered. Brian here got 3 double-doubles for himself. He won't mind giving you one, right? Peter locked eyes with Brian as he spoke. Dude, Brian said, as though he might protest. Then, digging into a bag, he pulled out 2 burgers, handing one to Jessica and another to Laura. He reached across Jessica, rather than walking around the bed where Laura sat in one of 2 chairs in the room. That's cool. I can stop for something on the way home. I need to score some basics, like beer and chips, before I go home anyway. Thanks. When Laura smiled at him, Brian the eating machine paused a moment before diving back into the fries he had been demolishing 3 or 4 at a time. No problem, he said, pausing again with a big grin on his face. Kim, do you want to sit over here next to me? Laura asked. Sure, Kim responded. She smiled a genuine smile, fleeting though it was, as she took a seat near Laura. Kim Reed was a puzzle. Smart as a whip and a hard worker, she was distant and skittish, yet vulnerable despite the sharp edges. The rest of the Cat Pack members had recognized that, welcoming her into their quirky little group with open arms, but still giving her space. Kim was the most feral cat among them. It was real progress that she often appeared at ease, content to be in the same room with them, even if long spells went by with little comment from her. It was the same way at the law office on El Paseo, where she kept to herself unless she felt she had something worthwhile to contribute. Amy Klein, the office manager, was a quiet soul, too. Jessica often felt like the odd duck as the most gregarious member of her work group. That was true, unless the charming attorney Worthington was in the building. This is wonderful, you guys. Real coffee and real food. Do I know how to pick my friends or what? I can't believe Nurse Andrews is letting us get away with this. She was talking with her mouth half full. Who knew when Nurse Andrews might pop in and spoil their little party? Jessica took another big bite of the scrumptious burger, not wanting to risk giving it up if there was a raid. "What's that?" Peter asked moments later. Their heads swiveled in Laura's direction. In the distance, a wailing sound could be heard. "Maybe Nurse Andrews is on to us," Jessica murmured, before taking another bite out of what was left of her double-double from In-N-Out Burger. "It sounds like a fire alarm, but it must be in another wing or building on the medical campus. Don't worry. If it had anything to do with us, we'd get a code, or I'd have a text message." Laura pulled her cell phone out of her pocket and checked it, just in case. "Nothing," she said, setting the phone down on the bedside table next to where she sat. She went back to devouring her burger, too. Several minutes passed before a calm but insistent voice sent out a message over the loudspeakers. "Code Silver, ICU. Repeat. Code Silver, ICU. Shelter in place. Repeat. Shelter in place. Code Silver, ICU. Repeat. Code Silver, ICU." Laura and Peter both stopped eating and went into action. Laura moved to turn the lights off in the room. Then she opened the door, pulled out a key, and locked it from the outside before shutting the door again. Peter closed the drapes and went to work securing the door from the inside. He made a wedge of magazines and jammed it into the corner of the door. He moved the chair Laura had been sitting in and adjusted the angle to add another wedge, this one under the door handle.
"What is it? What's going on?"
Brian asked. He didn't stop eating that second burger he was working on, but he had slowed down. "Code Silver means there's an emergency in the building. The ICU in this case, according to that announcement." Laura answered as she checked her phone for text messages sent out with emergency codes. "It says the same thing here. Code Silver, shelter in place until further notice." The eerie voice repeated the warning in the same unemotional, detached tone. "ICU, do you think it's Libby?" Jessica asked. "I don't mean Libby, but, you know, someone trying to get to her?" "I was down there earlier today. There was one other patient in the ICU, an older man who had suffered a serious heart attack. So, yes, my guess is this has something to do with Libby and the mess she's mixed up in." She spoke softly as she sat on the foot of Jessica's bed. "This mess we're all mixed up in, don't you mean?" Jessica asked, her stomach souring from stress, or from eating so fast, or some combination of the two. Her heart pounded. "It can't be too bad, or they would have issued an evacuation order. Most likely, we're not talking about multiple intruders or a bomb. They said stay put, so that's what we'll do." Peter spoke resolutely as he went back to eating his lunch. A gun had appeared from somewhere in response to the alarm. It now sat within easy reach as he faced the door, standing no more than a step or two from Jessica. Jessica rested her head on the pillow and tried to calm down. "He thinks someone might be coming for me," she thought. She kept the words to herself. Speaking them aloud would make things worse, adding to the suspense they already felt.
"No bomb? Okay, that's cool," Brian said as he moved back into high-speed eating.
"Cool isn't the word I would have chosen. It sounds like we have no choice but to wait it out. We're not in any immediate danger. No one's pounding on the door or trying to get in." That was the most words Kim had spoken since walking into the room. During the brief whirlwind of activity from Laura and Peter, she sat, frozen like a statue, taking it all in. When Peter went back to eating, she did too. They sat in silence for several minutes, waiting for an update. The minutes passed like hours. At the sound of a little ping, they all startled. Even Peter tensed up. It was Laura's phone. She read the text message aloud. Lone gunman. Shots fired. No injuries. Gunman's location unknown. Continue to shelter in place. Before anyone could comment or react, a sudden flurry of commotion began outside the door to Jessica's room. Peter grabbed the gun and moved closer to Jessica.
Do you know how to unhook this stuff, Laura?
He asked in a low voice, nodding toward the IV connected to Jessica.
Sure, no problem. Get her unhooked and help her into the bathroom. Brian, Kim, you get in there too, with Laura and Jessica.
As he spoke, someone jiggled the door handle.
Move it, you guys. Stand off to the side, not in the direct line of the doorway. Got that?
Got it, Laura said as she freed up the pole on which the IV bag hung so it could move with Jessica. Brian did not hesitate, not even long enough to take the last of his food with him. Neither did Kim, who also headed toward the bathroom. She paused for a moment to help untangle a cord that Laura was trying to free. Without the use of her left arm and her right hand connected to the IV, Jessica's exit from the bed was awkward. She had on one of the muumuus Bernadette had brought to the hospital, so she didn't have to worry about an exposed backside. Laura slid the rails all the way down on the side of the bed nearest the bathroom. She and Kim helped Jessica scoot to the edge of the bed and then waited as, with their support, she eased her way to the floor. Jessica winced as her ribs protested. The door handle jiggled again, and someone was pounding on the door now. Jessica and the rest of the crew hustled inside the bathroom, crammed into the tiny space. Brian stepped into the shower stall to make more room for the others. They heard another ping on Laura's phone as they shut and locked the door.
Shoot, Laura said.
She'd left the phone on the foot of the bed where she had put it down to assist Jessica. From inside the bathroom, they could hear more pinging, ringing, and pounding. It sounded like it was a long way off. Deceptive, since danger wasn't more than a few yards away.
10. Car chase. Eric was about to have a stroke. He couldn't believe what he was watching on television. Reporters filmed a man running at top speed from the hospital. Hospital security and a uniformed police officer weren't far behind him. First responders flocked to the scene, along with reporters from the local news outlets in the Palm Springs area. A police helicopter followed the man as he hijacked a car that had been waiting with the engine running in the patient pickup area. He yanked the driver out of the car, threw him on the ground, and fired two shots toward the officers chasing him on foot. Bystanders fled for cover. The officers he shot at ducked, giving him time to get into the car and take off. As he sped away, he turned onto the main street in front of the hospital complex and headed toward the I-10 freeway. A nearby police patrol car was after him in a split second. Not long after, two others joined the pursuit.
Shades of O.J. Simpson, Eric said as he slammed his fist on the desk. Damn it! When I get my hands on that son of a bitch, I will give him the O.J. treatment. Oh, hell. Let him clean up his own messes.
He pulled the burner phone from his pocket and called Kirk, who answered on the first ring. Eric didn't need to introduce himself.
This is unbelievable. What is going on? You were supposed to keep this simple. A quiet operation is what I asked for. What the hell happened? Jack says there was a cop at the hospital, some yokel with the county sheriff's department. He busted in on him, even with our distraction scenario in play. Jack had no choice but to get out of there. I'm not sure if he took care of the girl or not before that hero got into the act. I don't get it. Your guys can't pick out a cop? He wasn't in uniform and didn't look like a cop. He wasn't even wearing one of those crappy detective suits. Besides that, he had some old guy with him. Jack thought they were family members paying the girl a visit. He waited for them to leave the room before he ran down the steps, lit the fire in the basement, threw the alarm, and sprinted back up there. It was all working just fine. Jack's mic was on, so I heard the whole thing. When Jack slipped back into that room, I could hear people yelling for everyone to exit the building. Not 2 minutes after they left the girl's room, the two guys came back. That's when one of them identified himself as a cop, and I told Jack to get the hell out of there. What kind of idiot heads back into the room when everybody's telling him to leave? He and the old man with him had him cornered.
Jack had no choice but to wave a gun around. In fact, it was smart thinking and quick action that allowed him to get out of there at all. I don't want to hear any more. This is a disaster, and I want it stopped. Now, where are you? I'm in my SUV, en route to intercept Jack. I know what I've got to do. It makes me sick to lose a guy like that, but I'm on it. You better be. Clean this up, or I'll give you something to feel sorry about.
Eric ended the call. What was up with the Vanderwerp woman? Had that loser finished that part of the job at least before creating such a stink? He hoped so. With luck, Jack wasn't about to die for nothing. He continued to watch, fascinated as the helicopter feed of the car chase in the desert was broadcast live on LA networks. Californians loved their car chases. The stolen car was moving at high speed on a road heading toward the I-10 freeway on-ramp.
What an idiot, Eric muttered.
Even if he could get to the freeway, where was he going to go? West would take him to L.A. and massive traffic jams in no time. East led to nothing but a lot of highway and desert before reaching Blythe and the border with Arizona. Maybe that's what he was trying to do. No way would it work. Even if the car he stole had enough gas, the cops would be waiting at the state line. East or west, the police would have roadblocks up in no time. The good guys had him in the crosshairs, but so did his team leader. Police vehicles were in hot pursuit, sirens blaring. Other vehicles on the road tried like mad to get out of the way as the convoy hurtled down the thoroughfare. The car had to be traveling at close to 100 miles per hour, according to newscasters. As the car neared the last major intersection before reaching the freeway ramp, a tire blew. The car spun out of control. In the next instant, it hit a curb, flew up into the air, and then flipped over and over. After skidding 100 yards, the car came to rest, still upside down. Then the wrecked vehicle burst into flames.
Sorry, Jack, you poor schmuck, whoever you are. That's what you get when you don't do your job right.
He picked up his cell phone and redialed the number, breathing easier than when he had made the previous call.
Good job. Lucky for you.
Luck had nothing to do with it.
Now what? What do you mean, now what? You finished the job, that's what. Find out what's up with the Vanderwerp girl ASAP. If Jack didn't get it done, you do it.
There's no way I'm getting another crack at her today.
Okay, so lie low for now, until we get a report on Vanderwerp's status and things settle down. Keep tabs on that Huntington woman, too. She won't be in the hospital much longer. I want to know where she is until my business is concluded. Got that? The countdown is on, damn it! Shut up, Libby Vanderwerp, and don't let Jessica Huntington out of your sight. Do you think you can handle that?
Sure thing. The tone in Kirk's voice was irritating.
Don't get snippy with me. In fact, if you don't want trouble from me, you get your butt back over to the hospital now. You're a pro, Kirk, so don't tell me you can't at least figure out whether you need to clean up after Jack or not. If Libby Vanderwerp is still alive, I want to hear that from you. One more thing. If I find out that nut job is talking, I promise I'll take matters into my own hands. That won't do your reputation any good now, will it, Kierkegaard?
Eric knew he disliked being called by that, even though it was his real name. So what? If this screw-up got in Eric Conroy's way, Kirk wouldn't need to worry about his reputation, being called Kierkegaard, or anything else for that matter. Eric would bring in another company to fix this mess, and Kierkegaard Kunzel would be one of the loose ends that were tied up. Eric wished he could slam the phone down, like he used to do with a real phone. As the media replayed the whole chase scene, Eric stood there and watched. Rather than feeling horror or sadness when that car burst into flames, Eric felt relieved once again. The coverage went back live to the crash site. Not just the police, but fire and rescue had converged on the location. Dark black smoke billowed. He had the sound turned down low, but could hear the excited babble of talking heads doing voiceovers to go with the scenes being broadcast.
Their ratings just went through the roof as I get a kick in the pants. This can't go on.
With the IPO scheduled to launch on the 20th, all he needed was a few more days. The board would meet this Friday to hear from the joint bookrunners.
He presumed that boys at Golden Slacks and the other major investment firms honchoing the IPO would have good news to report. That assumption was based on snippets of info coming in about the roadshow that was underway. Eric didn't expect he'd have much to do to keep all his ducks in a row, no matter what happened. But he didn't like surprises and was taking no chances. Getting the votes to support the IPO had taken some doing. Even the CEO had required more convincing than Eric imagined it would take. No matter. Their fearless leader was on board now. The CEO was doing fine, too, as that dog and pony show made the rounds. If he were the CEO and chairman of the board, as he should have been, those meetings would be smoking. Pinnacle needed him at the helm. Well, had needed him. But it was too late for that now.
Too little too late, Eric muttered in anger. A few more days and it'll be clear what too little too late gets you, too. You should have put me in charge, and the future of Pinnacle might have gone in a different direction.
Eric spoke those words as if the board members were sitting in front of him. Then he sat down and started a countdown in his head as he marked off the days on a desk calendar. 10, 9, 8. In a matter of days now, Pinnacle would rise, attaining great heights, before crashing back to the earth like a misguided missile. By then, he and a quarter of $1 billion or more would be long gone. 11. The Shooter. The phone in Jessica's hospital room rang. Laura's cell phone was ringing, too. The pounding on the door continued, and Jessica thought she heard someone shouting her name.
Somebody's calling my name, Peter. What's going on? Jessica asked.
No bad guy would shout at me like that, right?
They haven't given us the all-clear yet over the loudspeakers, Laura responded. We should stay put until that call goes out.
You guys do that. I'll go check the phones, Peter said.
He had been fiddling with his own phone from the moment they entered the bathroom.
I can't get a signal in here, or I'd call somebody and ask. Lock the door behind me, Peter said as he opened the bathroom door and stepped back into the hospital room.
The pounding and shouting stopped a minute or two later. Peter returned and instructed them to unlock the door to the bathroom. When Jessica stepped from the bathroom back into the hospital room, it was full of people. Nurse Andrews was standing there with her arms folded across her chest. Behind her stood Jessica's doctor, another nurse, and a man in a suit who must have been a hospital administrator since he didn't have that surly cop look on his face. Next to them stood Frank Fontana, with Detective Hernandez on one side of him and Uncle Don on the other. Two men in hospital security uniform stood nearby, too. Eyes widened when Jessica stepped out of the bathroom, followed by Laura, then Kim, and last but not least, Brian.
It's like one of those little clown cars at the circus, Detective Hernandez said, shaking his head. Why am I not surprised? He commented to everyone in the room. I take it everyone's okay, Don Fontana commented, with a note of sarcasm in his voice. Hope we didn't disturb you.
No problem, man. We were just sheltering in place. A small place, but
hey, that's cool,
Brian said, before he turned around and went back into the bathroom.
Excuse me, I gotta go,
he said as he closed the door, peeking around the edge until he closed it.
Yes, we're fine. So kind of you to ask, Jessica sniffed. She didn't like the way this was going.
Wisecracks from Detective Hernandez signaled trouble, as did snide comments from Uncle Don. Nurse Andrews had donned a nasty Nurse Ratchet look as she moved to help Jessica back into bed. The nurse stopped to remove the container that had held Jessica's French fries, which had turned upside down, scattering fries and crumbs.
One moment, Miss Huntington, she said, a coldness in her voice as she cleaned up the scraps and brushed crumbs from the bed. Jessica glanced around the room. In their hurry to respond to the alarm, they had left uneaten food and wrappers scattered about.
So it's back to Ms. Huntington, is it? She thought, as the nurse guided her back into bed. Aloud, she asked, Are you all going to just stand there and gawk, or is somebody going to tell us what all this ruckus is about? Don't you dare try to pin anything on me, Detective Hernandez. I was lying here minding my own business, having lunch with my friends, okay?
Before anyone could say another word, Tommy and Jerry bounded into the room from the hallway. Tommy stopped, coming up quick to avoid bumping into his cousin Frank and Uncle Don. That caused Jerry to careen into him, shoving Tommy into Frank anyway. It was like a row of dominoes as Tommy jostled Frank, who nudged Detective Hernandez, who bumped into Uncle Don. Don stepped on the toes of one of the security guards, who knocked into a bedside tray, sending items flying in several directions. The nurses in the room scurried to clean up the new mess.
"How did you two get up here?"
"Carter.
Carter!"
the gentleman in the suit bellowed, donning a surly look now, too. He was a hospital administrator with authority over the security guys, judging by the commanding tone he used and the way the men in security outfits flinched.
"Yes, sir?" asked another member of the uniformed security team, who stepped into the room in response to that command.
"I thought we had this whole floor sealed off, including the elevator and the stairs."
"Yes, sir. It was, until we got the all-clear minutes ago on our cell phones."
Before he could say another word, the same disembodied voice that had sent out the code Silver announced the all-clear. The supervisor pulled his cell phone out and examined it.
"He's right. Someone went ahead and sent out the all-clear without contacting me first. Must have come from the higher-ups."
He sounded chagrined as he spoke to the group in the room. Jessica was about to speak again when there was more commotion outside the door. Bernadette dashed into the room, stunned for a moment because there were now about 20 people in the small hospital room. Jessica's parents stopped in the doorway, taking in the scene.
"Talk about your tiny clown cars," Jessica mumbled.
The door to the bathroom opened, and Brian stepped out to rejoin the throng.
"Hey, Mrs. B."
"Yo, dudes. Sup?"
Brian said, as if it was the most natural thing in the world to find them all there.
"Mom, Dad, squeeze on in. A gathering is being held in my honor, although no one has told me what we're celebrating."
"What we heard was that a gunman was on the loose, and that they had shut the whole place down. We got here as fast as we could. We were so afraid,"
Alexis said, as she pushed her way through the crowd to reach her daughter's bedside.
"Yeah, we got here as soon as we could, too," Tommy said. "We sat in traffic for a while because they had closed streets, and then we had to wait to get into the lot once the streets opened up again."
"I'm hungry," Brian said out of the blue.
A wave of puzzled looks spread around the room as they made a stab at processing that non sequitur.
"Hang on a minute, will you, Brian?" Jessica asked. "We knew someone was here at the hospital with a gun or other weapon. Laura filled us in on what a code silver means. What makes you think that has anything to do with me?" Jessica asked.
"Well, that's because the ruckus, as you called it, involved your friend in the ICU, Ms. Huntington."
"So it's back to Ms. Huntington with Detective Hernandez, too."
"Libby is, not a friend, Detective Hernandez," Jessica said, correcting the man. She tried for a second to figure out what she was. Not a client, not a friend. What? She gave up. "Is she okay?"
"She is, but it was a close call," Frank said,
answering the question before Detective Hernandez could respond.
"We were on our way to see how you were doing when we stopped by the ICU. We thought you might have some questions about Libby's condition, so we stopped in there first,"
Uncle Don said, pausing for a second, perhaps not sure how much he should say with so many people in the room. Detective Hernandez nodded, urging him to go on.
"The nurse on the ward said Libby was doing okay, and let us see for ourselves. When we stepped back out into the hallway from her room, a fire alarm went off."
"We heard that, but it didn't sound close enough to be concerned about," Laura said.
"A diversion, I imagine," Frank said. "Frank and I didn't know that then," Don added. "We took a quick look around trying to figure out if the problem was nearby. The alarm sounded like it was in the same wing, but we didn't smell smoke or see a fire. People were rushing to the central nurses' station to ask what was going on. We headed that way, too. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw somebody go into Libby Vanderwerth's room. I just glimpsed him. He was in scrubs, but something about him struck me as odd. Maybe the way he looked around before he stepped into the room. Something about him was just off."
When Dad said he saw someone go into Libby's room, I figured it was a member of the medical staff making the rounds. You know, checking on patients in the ICU disturbed by the sound of that alarm. Or maybe someone charged with getting Libby out of the building in an emergency situation.